Hey guys, this is Adam Carswell, and welcome back to another episode of the Lieberland Show. I'm joined today by Walter Block, Austrian economics wizard, if you will. I had the privilege of getting to know him and meeting him face-to-face not too long ago, and we were emailing throughout the week, and I said, hey, I'd love to bring you on the Lieberland Show, and he's like, how's right now? It basically was his response. I think we lined this up a couple days ago, so really happy to be jumping into the fire with him here, talking about the power of Austrian economics and beyond. So, Mr. Block, Professor Block, grateful to have you here. And any opening statements for our audience today?
Wizard Block sounds great.
Wizard Block is ready to rock. And that rhymed, and I didn't even mean for that. So anyways, Walter, could you just share a little bit about your background as far as how you first got introduced to Austrian economics? I know you shared a pretty cool story about Ayn Rand when I first met you last weekend. But if you could, maybe tie those two together as far as your journey into this part of the world, and we'll go from there.
Okay, I'm happy to do that. I'm Jewish. I was brought up in Brooklyn, and the Weltanschauung there is everyone's a pinko, and I was a pinko. And my views were indistinguishable from those of Bernie Sanders. Why do I mention him? Because he and I went to high school together for 4 years. We're on the track team. we ran in the same distances. I have to tell you my Bernie Sanders joke. My Bernie Sanders joke is, Bernie Sanders is not afraid of anything. He doesn't run away from anything much, within reason. He didn't run away from socialism. And he started in with the socialism long before it was as popular as it is now, mainly or to a great degree, because of his own efforts. In terms of voting, not only does he favor ex-cons voting, but he favors even people in jail now voting. He doesn't run away from that. But there's one person from whom he does run away, and that's me. Why? Because he was one of the best runners in the whole city. His time for the mile was, 4:20, and this is in high school. Right. I never broke 5. My best time was 5:05. So okay. We started off at the same starting point on the track meet, and he ran away from me. That's my Bernie Sanders joke.
I love that.
I was a pinko, and I was at Brooklyn College now. He and I overlapped 4 years in Madison High School and 1 year in Brooklyn College. And Ayn Rand came to speak at Brooklyn College, and I came to boo in his heart because, she favored free enterprise. And everyone knows that economic freedom, free enterprise, capitalism is an abomination. It creates misery and inequality and racism. It's just very, very bad. Now, in those days, this must have been around 1961, 62, somewhere in there. You don't cancel people. When you don't like a guest speaker, you don't try to beat them up like they do now. It was very polite, booing and hissing just a little bit whenever she'd say something in favor of capitalism, which was pretty much her whole speech. Well, in any case, afterward, they invited anyone to come to a lunch in her honor, even if you disagreed. And I wanted to convert her to socialism because, socialism is the way to go. And I got to the lunch room where they were having the lunch, and there was a long, long table, maybe 50 people on a side. And she was sitting at the head of it near her buddies, Nathaniel Brannan, Alan Greenspan, Leonard Peikoff, and her crew. And there was no seats there. So I went to the other end of the table and I sat down and I turned to my neighbor and said, socialism is the way to go. Capitalism is evil. And he said, well, I don't really know all that much about it, but the people who do are at the other end of the table. So I went and I stuck my head in between Ayn's and Nathan's, and I was maybe 20, 22 then, and Brandon maybe 35 and Rand 50 or 55. And I stuck my head in there and I said, there's a socialist who wants to debate someone on socialism and capitalism. And they said, who is it? I said, me. And Brandon was very, very nice and very gentle. He said, look, there's no room at this end of the table. But I'll come to the other end of the table, and on two conditions. One, you don't allow the debate to lapse until we settle this. And two, you read two books that I'll recommend. Well, we talked about it for an hour the first time, and I went to his house and Rand's house several times. And I read the two books, Atlas Shrugged and Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. And I was converted. I was now minarchist, limited government libertarian, free enterpriser. I never really understood their metaphysics and epistemology, and also I was turned off because it was a little cultish. At the NBI lectures, Nathaniel Brannan Institute lectures, if you asked a nice question, that was fine. You could say, well, on Atlas Shrugged, you know, page 502, you said this, could you elaborate? Perfectly nice question, she would answer. But if you said on page 502, you said this, and on page 706, you said that, and I see a contradiction between them, she would kick you out of the meeting. It was the most appalling thing. And, you know, sometimes I joke with my students that if they ask a question I don't like, I'm going to kick them out of the class, but I'm just being silly. But I sort of had a schizophrenic existence because these were the only free enterprise people I knew. So I'd go to their meetings and then I'd get disgusted and I'd stay away for a few months. And then I knew of no other people and I'd come back. Then I graduated Brooklyn College and I was now getting my PhD in economics at Columbia. And a fellow student of mine, Larry Moss, said, based on our discussions in class, he knew I was a free enterpriser. He said, you must meet Murray Rothbard. He's an anarchist. I said, anarchist? I don't want to meet an anarchist. They're crazy. Because remember, I was sort of a limited government libertarian then. But finally, he and his roommate, Jerry Wallows, ganged up on me, prevailed upon me to meet Murray. And in about 10 minutes, using economics in one lesson arguments, you know, why should we privatize the post office? Well, because competition brings about a better product. Well, why not apply that to courts or armies or police? And Murray converted me. And then it was 10 minutes, but he never could convert me. Well, for the longest time, I was not an Austrian. Why was I not an Austrian? And now, before I get into why I'm not an Austrian, let me just talk a little bit about what is Austrian economics. Mm-hmm. Austrian economics has nothing to do with the country Austria. It's just that it's called Austrian economics because the people that started this school of economic thought just happened to be in Austria. Von Weizsäcker, Menger, Mises, Hayek, Schumpeter, they were all in Austria, so it became the Austrian school. It's similar to the Chicago School of Economics. It's got nothing to do with the city Chicago. It's just that the people who started it, Milton Friedman, Aaron Director, George Stigler, Gary Becker, just happened to be at the University of Chicago. They could have been at the University of Timbuktu, then it would have been the Timbuktu School of Economics. So what I'm going to talk about Austrian economics a lot, but what was the sticking point for me? I had no problem with their views on monopoly, with their views on business cycles, with their views on inequality. What I had a problem with was their views on the synthetic a priori. What's the synthetic a priori? Well, before I get into the synthetic a priori, let me say that according to the logical positivists, the people who prevail in all of academia and run pretty much everything, there are two kinds of statements. There are absolutely true, non-deniable statements that nobody could disagree with, but have nothing to do with the real world, just have to do with how we use language. For example, bachelors are unmarried men. Bachelors are unmarried men. If you find a married man, he can't be a bachelor. There's no question about it because it's definitional. 2 + 2 = 4 is another one. The Pythagorean theorem, most things in mathematics, they're all analytic. They have nothing to do with the real world, supposedly, but they are based on, predicated on how we use language, how we define language, bachelors, unmarried men. And then there are synthetic statements or empirical statements like it's raining outside. Now, whether it's raining outside or not, you don't know for sure because some days it rains, some days it doesn't. Adam is wearing a black shirt, Walter is wearing a white shirt. It could have been reversed. You have to look to see if it's true. So they have something to do with the real world, but they're not apodictically necessarily true. So now comes the question, are there any synthetic a priori statements? Are there any statements that are absolutely true, undeniable, and yet say something about the real world? The Austrians say yes, and I couldn't get my mind around that for a year or two. It just seemed so cultish. And Austrians are dismissed in academia as cultish, because we believe that there are such things as a synthetic a priori statement, one that says something about the real world that is important, and two, is undeniable. For example, and now let's get back into economics.
Okay, yeah, I want to know what the statement is.
Here's a statement. You bought, you're now wearing earphones.
Correct.
You bought those earphones for $100.
Sure.
Let's say. Uh-huh. I say as an economist that at the time you bought them, you valued them more than the $100. Otherwise, why would you buy them? Now, it might be that you didn't value those earphones per se. It's because a pretty girl, your now wife, was selling them and you wanted to get a date with her. And you thought the earphones were crappy, but you wanted a date with your present wife, who was then a strange girl. And you bought them. All we know is there was something about these earphones that you valued more than $100. And usually it's the earphones, but it could have been anything. It could have been you felt sorry for the salesman. Who knows? Who cares? We know that there's something about those earphones that you valued more than 100. Otherwise, why would you pay 100? This is Mises's human action. What he says is all human action, and by this he means not only commercial action, but look, you invited me to be on your show. I deduce from the fact that you invited me to be on your show, you thought that it would be a good idea, that it would help your program or whatever it was. Namely, you would gain more than you lost. What did you lose? Well,
30, it's an exchange of time for
something. Yes, you lost an hour.
My 30 minutes is worth having you here, right?
Right.
Yeah.
You could have had another guest. Who knows what you lost, but at the time you invited me, you thought that it would be to your benefit. And what Mises says, who is probably the greatest Austrian economist, is that all of human action is an attempt to make the future a little bit better than it otherwise would have been had you not acted. Well, that's a synthetic a priori statement.
Wow, that's a great
statement. That is necessarily true. You can't test that. How can you?
I'm sure you've seen it. How do people try to argue that statement?
Oh, they just call us cultists. They don't argue. We're a cult because everyone knows that either a statement is necessarily true and tautology, or it's an empirical statement that you can test to see if it's true. For example, is it raining or not? You got to go look outside the window to see. Or will the minimum wage law create unemployment for unskilled workers? Now, we Austrians say that's a synthetic a priori. It necessarily will. Other things equal, holding everything ceteris paribus, everything else equal, we say that a minimum wage law will create unemployment for unskilled workers because, look, suppose the minimum wage law is $7 an hour, and suppose my productivity is $5 an hour. Well, if you hire me, you're going to lose $2 an hour. Now, you might hire me, but eventually you're going to go broke. So what we're saying is that in equilibrium, a minimum wage law of $7 an hour will unemploy everyone whose productivity is less than $7 an hour. Now, there are two schools of that are supposedly free enterprise. One is the Austrian, the other is the Chicagoan that I mentioned before. The Chicagoans are pretty good on things like that libertarians would be concerned about, such as minimum wage law, rent control, free trade, stuff like that. They all say, yes, yes, we have to have free trade. Minimum wage and rent control are, you know, not only violations of rights, which they wouldn't say because they don't like to be libertarians, but they would say that they have negative repercussions. The minimum wage screws up housing, tariffs screw up welfare, economic welfare, and minimum wage creates unemployment. But you have to test it. We say, well, you can do an empirical econometric equation on that all you want, but all you're doing is illustrating it. You're not really testing it because the truth of it is not in play. It's absolutely necessarily true. So that is one of the aspects of Austrian economics that it took me a long, long time to wrap my mind around, but you know, finally I did. I'm a true blue Austrian. And there are even Hayek is not a true blue Austrian in this sense because he doesn't follow Mises in the synthetic a priori. Look, Murray Rothbard used to say every dog gets one bite. I would say every dog gets five bites. Hayek's still an Austrian, even though he doesn't agree on what I think is the crucial contribution of Austrian economics. He made wonderful contributions to the business cycle theory and other information stuff that Hayek did on central planning. So that's sort of a...
Yeah, there's a lot running through my head right now. I love the idea, and I wish that I knew, I guess you could say, like a society or a place in the world where a lot of these principles were put into practice. Like I always like to say, to your point, you know, the privatization of police or getting the roads taken care of, anything that's kind of run by the state, that's the one go-to. I think I'm sure you've seen before too, when you tell people, you know, taxation is theft, and then they go, well, what about the roads? And I don't know about you, but I know if a community, there's sometimes potholes right outside that will sit there for a year. And if the community could legally just go take care of their own roads, it'd probably be better off than waiting on the government to spoon feed everyone. So any government run organization, I think I would love for it to have an opportunity to be run privately, but I don't really know anywhere in the world that we can go to see that work. Maybe besides Lieberland here, you know, as this idea grows. But are you seeing anywhere in the world where the actions of Austrian economics are actually, you know, really being put to use well?
Well, now you really can't say it quite that way, because Austrian economics is, what's the word? Positive economics. It's not really normative economics. Libertarianism is normative or ethical. All of economics, properly understood, is just positive, namely, what causes what? How do we explain and understand reality? Why do we have unemployment? But it's really, strictly speaking, not a value-laden concept. Now, it's true that virtually all Austrians are libertarians, but you could have, not only could you have, but there were Austrians who were Nazis. Look, Austrian economics started in Austria in, I don't know when, 1875, 1890 with Menger. There were plenty of Austrians in the 1930s, some of whom were Nazis. So Nazis are bad guys. And yet you could be a Nazi Austrian. You could be very evil and be an Austrian economist, just like you could be very evil and be a good chemist, or very evil and be a good plumber. So Austrian, all of economics, not just Austrian economics, is an attempt to understand reality and explain what's going on in, I don't know, the stock market or why we have inflation. But you could be evil and yet be correct in that. So you don't want to say that or imply or think that all Austrians have to be. Now, most of them are. I don't know of any, but a buddy of mine, Richard Ebeling, who's more into history of thought than I am, assures me that there were Nazi Austrians, and it's not a contradiction in terms, whereas it's a contradiction in terms to say a Nazi libertarian, because
right.
Libertarianism opposes the initiation of violence, and Nazis don't oppose the initiation of violence against innocent people.
What was it like? And actually, could you explain to our audience, myself included, because I've heard you use this phrase a few times, and I apologize, maybe it's I'm either uneducated or I'm just too young. What is a pinko?
Oh, pinko is, I mean, a commie is red.
Okay.
Well, a pinko is slightly red. Namely, okay. not an avid communist, but a socialist, an interventionist, a Democrat, people like that.
Got it. Got it.
The woke people are all pinkos. Some of them are red.
It's the former version of woke.
a red would be a pure commie. And
according to because in the U.S. it's the opposite, right? It's blue and red are kind of flipped compared to most countries. But you're referring to red, I guess. I live in Canada, right? So then that would be, am I right?
Yeah, that's right. The U.S. Reverses it. The Democrats are blue states and the Republicans are red states. They, it should be reversed. But then again, the word liberal is also reversed. In the U.S., liberal means pinko.
Right.
And in Europe, liberal means libertarian, or, you know, limited government, classical liberal, stuff like that. So there is a reversal, but I think the word pinko is a phrase that everyone should at least be aware of. But I wanted to mention roads and potholes. One of my books is on why we should privatize roads. And my main impetus for that was not potholes. It was that in the US, some 40,000 people a year die on the roads. And in Canada, something like 4,000. Canada is usually 1/10 of the US in virtually everything. And the usual explanation for this is, oh, speeding and vehicle malfunction and driver inattention. But the way I see it, it's rather the government's failure to deal with those problems. So those are only the proximate causes. The ultimate cause is that the government isn't dealing with them. And under free enterprise, if you had one highway and I had another highway, we would be competing to see who could reduce deaths the most.
Right.
And, you know, for example, how could this be done? Well, right now in Canada and in the US, the speed limit is something like 70 miles an hour, 100K in Canada or 110K. Mm-hmm. In the US, it's usually 70. Well, maybe on a six-lane highway, the three lanes, maybe what we should do instead of having a minimum of 40 miles an hour and a maximum of 70, would be each lane should have its own speed limit. The right-hand lane should be 60, the left-hand lane should be 75, and the middle lane 75, and the left lane 90. Or maybe it should be 60, 70, and 80. I don't know. It's an empirical issue. This is not a synthetic a priori. We don't know in advance what's the best way to do it. We have to find out through competition and entrepreneurship. And you try something on your road, I try something on my road. And let's say my road is better, and I'll try to get customers away from your road. And then we'll find out what's the best way to have speed limits. And whereas right now, it either comes from Ottawa or Washington, D.C., And there's no competition. Well, why do we have pretty good shirts and earphones? Well, because we have competition. Well, why shouldn't that apply to roads? And so
what's the name of your book, real quick? Just, I know you've written multiple publications throughout the years, but which one are you talking about right now?
I forget the title, something like Privatizing Roads and Highways.
Okay.
And
streets, I'll look it up, guys.
Good.
Yeah. I love this topic because it is the one argument that I try to make, and I'd like to hear your thoughts here so I can kind of gather some more information and ammo for myself for these conversations. But really, I mean, what I like to ask people is, think of the last time you went to a state-run organization and had a pleasant experience. And I think the best answer that I've heard recently, and I didn't ask this question directly, but it's funny, living in the beautiful Socialist Republic of Canada now, in order to enter back into the country, you have to check in with the government online before you enter. Otherwise, they're going to give you a hard time at the border. And so I heard someone talking about, it's called the Arrive Can app, and saying, oh, you know, it's so easy to use now. I did it in 5 minutes or whatever. And I said, you know what? It's interesting how now we're saying, oh, that was a good experience. You shouldn't even have to do that in the first place, really. So, yeah, if you could just talk about what maybe like the privatization of police would look like, because that's another one I think people have a hard time wrapping their mind around. Oh, if it's not run by the state, how do we know it's legitimate? I think privatizing security is probably could be one of the most beneficial things for society.
Well, before I do that, I think you're being unfair to our big brother government. I mean, there are certain places that are pretty nice. So like I'm right now in Vancouver in the Stanley Park, and Stanley Park is gorgeous, and it's provided by government. Now, I mean, if government takes, what is it, half the GDP, eventually they'll do something good with it. But on privatizing the police, I think right now there are more private police than there are government police. I'm not sure about that, but it's close. I'm talking about private detectives, guards, people in a shopping mall that have a little uniform and look around for shoplifters. And if two people get into a fight, they're going to stop the fight. So there are private police already, and there are detectives. The question, one problem is right now, if let's say there's a rape occurring, and we don't, the problem is the woman who's being raped, did she pay for the police protection? And what are you going to do? Check that out before you stop the rape? So this would be an argument against privatization of the police. But the counter argument would be, well, look, the rape has to take place somewhere, on a street or in a park or in a shopping mall or somewhere. And the owner of that place would then have a an arrangement with the police. So let's take Stanley Park. I own Stanley Park. And what I do is I make a deal with the Adam police force. And I say, Adam, make sure nothing untoward occurs in Stanley Park. So if one of your policemen sees a rape, he doesn't have to ask the lady, well, did you pay?
you just go in there and
stop it. And So that would not be a good argument against privatization.
The privatization typically can provide for a quicker response too, because that's another big complaint that people get. Oh, the police took a half hour to get here. If it was privatized, it could have been 3 minutes.
Again, if the Adam police force is slow in responding and the Walter police force is quicker, well, then I'm going to outcompete you.
Competition.
And I'll provide a better service. And this is the same thing with shoes and shirts and peas and carrots. Why do we have pretty good things like that? Because of competition. Well, why not apply it to police? There's nothing sacrosanct about police. Now, you might say, well, it's hard. Let's say, I teach in New Orleans, in Loyola University, New Orleans, and the French Quarter is very populated. And Bourbon Street is a place where people go on Friday night, and it's sort of wall-to-wall people. Well, how could you tell who paid for it? Let's suppose you don't want to go Bourbon Street. Let's say Bourbon Street is still not private. If Bourbon Street were private, then the owner of Bourbon Street would make a deal with the police force and say, make sure everyone behaves. But suppose we still had public streets. And now the question comes, well, did this person pay for police protection or not? Should we protect them? I used to run in high school. I can't run anymore.
Which, that's awesome. I didn't know you were a runner, by the way. I ran track and field too. So that's great.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Which distances did you run?
I was, you guys probably would have made fun of me because I was a sprinter. So 400 was the furthest. The distance guys would always make fun of us,
you were a sissy. I've had two hip replacements and a knee replacement, so I can't run anymore, but I do competitive race walking. And sometimes I've never done a full marathon, but a half marathon, and there'll be 5,000 people in it. And that if you start walking along in the half marathon or running in the half marathon and you haven't paid, what they'll do is they'll arrest you for theft of services. Well, how do they tell who's who? What they do is they give you a little bib that sort of looks like this, and you paste it on your shirt. And if you don't have one of those, you're a thief. Well, you could do the same thing on Bourbon Street. People would now have a little thing on their lapel that they paid for police service. You could do this for fire protection. If your house is on fire and you didn't pay, well, I can make a quick deal. Give me half the value of your house and I'll put out the fire. So we have our ways to distinguish people who've paid and people who haven't. Namely, in technical language, can you exclude non-payers? There are ways of excluding non-payers. You see, if you can't exclude a non-payer, then according to the mainstream economics, what you have is a public good, and only the government can do a public good. But what I'm trying to say is that fire protection and police protection are not public goods. There are no public goods. There are no market failures, of which public goods are supposed to be one. And we have ways of excluding non-payers. And I've been, illustrating that by ownership of the Bourbon Street or ownership of Stanley Park, or by putting a little mark on lapel of people on their shirt. And now you can exclude non-payers.
Right. And then, man, we could probably go for another at least 30 minutes. We do have to start winding it down. But I think what would be your response here in closing? I'm sure the counter argument there is like, oh, well, what about the people who never had an opportunity to afford it in the first place? And as someone who, my father grew up in the hood in the east side of Cleveland, he's come very far for his life based on me coming from the middle class to where I'm at right now, I think I've come pretty far. And so like, it's not like it's impossible for people to cross the chasm into a realm in which they can afford and pay for things. But what's the response to someone who thinks, oh, it's not fair for someone who can't afford it?
That's a very, very good objection that the lefties, the pinkos, the socialists always make to privatizing anything. What about the poor? How would the poor get on the roads if we privatize the roads? How would the poor get into Stanley Park if you charge for Stanley Park? How would the poor get police protection? Well, it's a very good question. One answer is there, I won't say there wouldn't be any poor in the free enterprise, but there'd be a lot fewer poor, because one of the reasons we have poor people is we don't have free enterprise. So people would be a lot richer than they are now if we had free enterprise. Another answer for that is, look, the poor have some money. They can get into the shopping mall, and the shopping mall owner wants the poor because the poor's money, even though they don't have as much of it, they have some. And if you're in the shopping mall, everyone's protected from hooligans or what have you, or take roads. Okay, the poor can't get on the road unless they carpool. Now you get five people in a car, and now you can pay to get across the bridge, the Washington Bridge in New York City, or the, the Lionsgate Bridge in Vancouver. Okay, one person could probably get across the bridge at 3 a.m, because at 3 a.m, due to peak load pricing, you're not going to charge much, if anything, to get across the bridge. But it, you want to go into Vancouver at, 8:30 a.m. to go to work, it's going to cost a bit. And then you'll get rid of congestion that way. So the poor get on a bus, and now there are 35 people or 50 people on the bus, and they can afford it. Look, the poor can afford. Right now, if you work at McDonald's and you ask people if you want fries with that, you're pretty poor. You can afford a little car, maybe not a new car, maybe not a Mercedes, but you can afford a car. Whereas in countries that are not capitalist, even the middle class can't afford a car. They have to, go on roller skates or a bicycle or something like that. So I think the answer to the objection, what about the poor, is there'd be fewer poor, and the poor would be taken care of a lot better than the middle class are treated in non-free enterprise areas.
Yeah, wow. And it's mainly, if you look at it, it's the poor who are born into a society that is already kind of giving them these certain benefits for being poor, because a lot of the, if you look at the millionaires created throughout this capitalist society in North America, a lot of them were formerly poor, maybe from whether it be Mexico or somewhere in Europe or Africa or wherever. They come and they do the carpools and they do the buses at 3 a.m. or whatever it takes to get to that level where then they can eventually afford it. And that is something that you see common in free enterprise.
Right. I mean, in Mexico, a lot of people in Mexico, South America, Venezuela want to be in the United States because they'll be less poor, because we have more free enterprise than Mexico or Central or South America. We have controlled experiments, East and West Germany, North and South Korea. You look at voting with your feet. It doesn't mean you try to grab the ballot box with your feet. It means the migration patterns. People were not moving from West Germany to East Germany. They were not moving from South Korea to North Korea. You had two different systems in North Korea and East Germany that they were socialist. They took care of the poor. And yet people were trying to leave, and they were shooting them as they try to leave. So I think this is a very powerful response to the objection, what about the poor?
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, Walter, thank you so much for investing a little bit more than a half hour of your time with us here today. We're really appreciative of it. And I think we'll definitely have to arrange for you to come back on the show at some point. This has been awesome. Any closing remarks or comments from you?
Well, you're a great interviewer, and I'd be delighted to come back. And I'm always looking for students. So if you're a student listening to this, think of enrolling at Loyola University New Orleans and studying with me and my free enterprise colleagues.
Love that. And I'll endorse that. And two, it is a breath of fresh air to know that there are still some sane teachers out there in the modern education system. So Walter, thank you for all you do to impact the lives of your students. And what's the best way for anyone tuned in to follow up and get in touch with you, or maybe read some of your publications? What do you recommend?
Just Google Walter Block and you'll find a lot of stuff. I've written a lot of books and articles and you'll find stuff.
There we go. Thank you. All right, Walter. Again, thank you. Yep, for investing your time with us and everyone tuned in here to the Lieberland Show. Thank you again for tuning in. I'm your host, Adam J. Carswell, and we will catch you guys in the next episode.